Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another live broadcast of Urban Literary Review. This show is hosted by Tia of DC Bookman and Martin of Culture First, and we are very excited about hosting a show that highlights the works of African descendants. The mission of our show is to highlight writers, related industry professionals, and book clubs while providing valuable information that you, the listener, can use and implement. Each and every Thursday at 7 p.m., you can chat live, call in, or listen in as we interview and spotlight professionals within the industry. It is our hope that each and every week that we can provide you with useful information. Culture First, are you there?
I'm here. Blessed to be here again, Queen.
All right. We have a very exciting lineup this evening. We have author Moses Miller, Once Upon a Time in Harlem, and The Trifling Times of Nathan Jones calling in to discuss his work and his upcoming projects. And in the second half, we have the Sister Friend Book Club calling in to tell us a little bit about their books and the projects that they have coming up. And also in the second half, we have book clubs, authors, and industry professionals calling in to let us know what they're working on, their current and future projects that they're working on. Tonight's call-in number is 347-215-8932, and I'm going to start the chat as of now, so the chat boards are also open. So what's the dealio in New York?
I don't know. It's kind of quiet. I think it's going to be quiet until maybe December, right before Kwanzaa. So as far as I know, it's not a lot of things happening in New York. We did have there was a poetry festival, but that was poetry / music that already passed. We do have, for those that may not be familiar with Carla B., she's from Entrepreneurs on the Move. She's coming to New York tomorrow. And next week we got April Sims coming to the Sugar Bar.
April Sims?
Yeah, April Sims is hitting New York at the Sugar Bar next week.
Oh, wow.
So, but other than that, it seems like we have, across the country, we have a couple of events that's happening. I know Lisa Woodson over at the author of Every Woman Needs a Wife is having a conclave of authors. And you can go to her website, Macro Publishing, which is MACRO Publishing. She's having an event next week in Chicago. And then the week after that, you have November, I think it's 7th and 8th in Detroit, the Essence of Motown Literary Awards. At that same weekend, you have in Maryland, you have the Black Web Awards. A lot of people don't really know about it, but they're the only people that award websites, awards to Black websites. They're having their event in Maryland.
Okay. Well, I have a couple of things coming up tomorrow. We're still doing the Grown and Sassy tour here. We have Shay Parker, author of The Tragic Flaw, coming to Foggy Bottom, 23rd and I Street Northwest, for anyone located in the D.C. metropolitan area. And then Saturday, we were supposed to have Gregory B. Williams, and he had to cancel. So we're going to be at Howard University for Howard's homecoming.
Oh, okay.
That's a lot of fun. Yeah. And we had the Get 'Em Girls last week. That was a lot of fun. I wish you could have been here for that. Those girls can cook.
What type of event was that?
That was a social network and mixer and tasting. So that went very well. We had about 40 women that actually attended that event, and they make this awesome dish called monkey bread. And
oh, yeah. Where are they from? Are they from North Carolina?
They live in New York, actually. I'm not really sure where they're from, but they are very down-to-earth and just very, you know, they're the Get 'Em Girls. They're awesome at what they do, and, you know, they cook for us, and I think that food was gone within, like, 2 minutes.
Wow.
So they had to actually go into some recooking for us because we were just overwhelmed with their chicken, and they had sweet potato wedges and string bean bondage. It was just a beautiful
Wait, string bean bondage?
Yes, you have to see it. You have to get the book. You got to get the book.
Excuse me.
But everything was very, very tasteful. And we got some footage on it. Hopefully I can get you to work on it for me because I'm not that tech savvy as of yet. And I have some pictures that I'm going to post. But if the Get 'Em Girls are in your area, definitely reach out to them and try to bring them into your book club, to your book events, because believe me, you won't be disappointed.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
Definitely.
We have Moses on the line.
Okay. All right. Let's bring him on.
Welcome, Moses, to Urban Literary Review.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Hey, Brother Miller.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Okay, I wanted to invite you on just to share with our listeners a little bit about Moses Miller, the man, Mind Candy Media, the company, and the books, The Trifling Times of Nathan Jones and Once Upon a Time in Harlem.
Right. Well, where do I start? I'll start with Moses Miller. I guess my first book that I released was The Trifling Times of Nathan Jones. That wasn't my first literary work, per se, because I used to write for Newsday. I used to write for The Voice in New York. But when I wrote The Trifling Times of Nathan Jones, I was actually writing a book that I think it was around the time where in New York you had, like, Timothy Stansbury, who had gotten killed, and Patrick Dorsman, like a lot of things that maybe outside of New York people didn't hear about, but there were events that were taking place, you know, that really didn't get the footage or they weren't deemed as newsworthy outside of New York, as say Sean Bell's murder. So when I started writing a book about a young man who basically was in a situation where he was, you know, he dealt with some victimization, but it was really a coming-of-age story from a young black male's perspective, and it dealt with everything from, you know, love lost, losing your parents, and basically being raised on your own, but also the element of corruption, because I thought that was important to put that inside of the book. And I ended up self-publishing that book because there were several publishers that were interested at the time, but going through the process of them telling me to take certain things out because it was too real in regards to real initiatives amongst the police department that were going on, for my artistic integrity, I didn't want to sacrifice that, so I put the book out on my own. And that was probably one of the best moves that I could have made, because within the time of putting that out, I've learned so much, and you know, I've had a slow but steady climb of just more readers getting familiar with my work and really exposing myself to, you know, different areas throughout the United States and abroad. So it's been a real good ride. And that, as a result of that, Feds Magazine actually, they had seen the book, read the book, and they asked me to pen a novel that's called Once Upon a Time in Harlem, which came out around the time of the Harlem Book Fair. We released it to the streets, but it officially was in stores in September of this year.
Okay. Now, the first book, going back for a minute, was that also the same time the Larry Davis thing happened, or was that?
It was after Larry Davis, but,
okay.
I mean, as far as the book itself deals with a lot of those same elements because, you know, once again, people know about Larry Davis. But
some people, though, you might want to school them, because I'm in New York like you, so we got the DVD.
I'm not New York, and I'm not aware of who he is, so please educate me.
Yeah, I mean, like Larry Davis' story is a story of a man that got into an altercation with the police where it was a shootout with police officers. But when you really trace his story.
25 cops stormed the house, and he survived and got out the window, and the bullets were flying right next to his head.
Exactly.
He took out 8 cops or something like that.
Yeah, and it was wild because when you trace his story back, it's like he tells a story of his story is one where allegedly there were some activities that he was involved in that the police were well aware of. You know, that the police may have been actually assisting him in doing. Or
that precinct was later on, you know, they did a house cleaning in that precinct later on.
Yeah.
And for a number of years, it kept coming back up out of that same precinct. The dirty cop situation kept coming back up.
In the same situation, you could speak to people on the streets who could give you stories of other people that may have had similar situations, which you never heard their story. So that's why when I wrote that book, people asked me, why did you write it as told to? And the reason why I wrote it as told to wasn't that somebody, say, told me this story, but I wanted to write a story from the perspective of an individual who just, his pleas or his story is always going to fall on deaf ears because he doesn't have that voice. Because there's plenty of people who just don't, they don't have the opportunity to sit in front of the news and say, I got victimized, or this is my story. So you may know or know of that story or know something similar because you live in that neighborhood or you're exposed to it. But if you're not in that neighborhood, you're not in New York, you're not in Baltimore or wherever it occurred, you'll never know about it. So that's why I wrote it from that perspective.
Right, and just so Tia and our audience can actually understand the Larry Davis story, he was a brother, allegedly, that was selling drugs for certain police officers, allegedly, and they decided that, you know, it's time to clean house and make sure that he was taken care of. They sent in a squad, and that first initial people, they didn't think that he was smart, and they didn't think he already peeped was going to happen, and he basically barricaded himself in to where everybody that came to the front door got shot. And he still was able to make it out of that particular building onto another building. And that's when the entire New York City police force came out, like literally as though 500 to 1,000 cops came after one man.
Wow.
And he negotiated himself, and somebody else helped him negotiate too, his release. But if it wasn't for the fact that the media got involved, negotiated, he'd have been taken out. Mm-hmm. But they negotiated his release, and he walked out. I think he was in a project building or another building. I'm not sure if it was the New York City Housing Authority building, but he walked out alive. And ever since then, you know, every time he goes up for parole, naturally he gets turned down. But it was a sort of and he wasn't a dumb kid. You know, he was sort of like what BET has been doing. I guess BET eventually would do a story on him, American Gangster, because they did a story on Melvin Williams this week. And it's that same story. This is a guy who has a high IQ. This is not somebody who was stupid. But it was average for what was happening in Harlem at the time.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. Good evening, caller. Welcome to Urban Literary Review.
Hello?
Hello, caller. Okay. I'm not sure what happened there.
They might have forgot their call. They have a number program that they called.
Uh-huh.
While I was in his pocket. That sort of like, sound like treasure, though.
I don't think it was treasure, though, looking at the area code.
Okay. But so you wrote for different newspapers, and then...
Yeah.
You decided that you were going to go ahead and pen the book because were you just fed up with what was being, unlike today, we have quick and fast, easy ways of getting information out. Back then, it was not back then that many years ago, but back then we didn't have but two or three forms of media that we had access to.
Yeah. I mean, my motivation for writing that book, really, honestly, it was just, I write all the time. I've been writing since I was 7, so.
Wow.
Yeah. So and when I, you know, back then, I tell the story a lot, but I wrote a chapter book when I was 7, and my teacher actually sent it to the astronauts. She sent it to the NASA astronauts who had gone up in a space shuttle at that particular time, and they wrote back to me. They gave me pictures and, you know, basically, you know, kind of inspired me at a young age. Like, wow, you know,
yeah,
you know. And so I've always been writing since then. So it wasn't, I mean, I'm never not writing.
Gotcha.
I always, you know, my time is always spent. Any free time, I'm going to be writing something. And it's just really anything, like, if I take, because I have books that are written that whenever they get released or I decide to release them, they'll just capture it's like it'll capture that point in time, what I was thinking. And maybe if I look back on that time and I say, all right, this was written at this particular time, there may be something significant that may have inspired it in a way. Like, it may, if I'm writing something now, it may be something that actually, you know, the Genesis 6 may inspire something in me.
Right, right.
You know, because that's something that I'm feeling right now. That's something that's frustrating me right now. And, you know, so it may be depicted in my writing in regards to not per se maybe that storyline, but just in regards to my focus at that period of time. Because to me, it's not always just about, I could creatively write. I always, you know, character development and understanding how to structure story, that's something that I really take pride in. But I also think that it's important that you have something to say, even if it's subliminal, but your readers should be left with something. Like a girl told me the other day that you want me to think. Yeah, I do want you to think. you know.
She doesn't. Yeah, they don't. I could go on about that concept. I mean,
so
you,
tell
as
me a little
writer,
bit about
go ahead,
Once Upon a Time in Harlem, because I read The Trifling Times. I loved it, by the way. That was a great read. You did an excellent job, and I'm waiting on the movie to come out, Mr. Miller. So let me know when that comes to my nearest theater.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about Once Upon a Time.
Motivation. Once Upon a Time in Harlem, the book is about a man, John Williams, that travels up north from the south to escape racism. And when he comes to Harlem, and he's here, his only, the skills that he has is really just working with his hands.
Mm-hmm.
But he's looking at New York as a land of opportunity. So he brings his younger brother up here with plans of bringing his whole family up north once he gets established. And he quickly realizes that the racism that he was, you know, trying to escape just exists in another manner, shape, and form in New York. So after really, you know, being here for a while, but becoming familiar with the Harlem landscape, he realizes that there's hustlers that are here that are making money, and they're not really doing anything positive for the community. So it wouldn't really make that much of a difference if he robs one of them. Well, the robbery turns into a homicide, and him and his brother get involved in a world that they really didn't want to get involved in. And over time, without giving too much of the story away, what he realizes is that everything that he was, you know, he pointed his finger at the hustlers and he was trying to escape racism, and he was looking at all of these things as negative, negative things that would impact his family, and he is all of those things. He's becoming all of those negatives that he's trying to get away from to his family by his actions. So that's the premise of the story. The story itself was actually, I enjoy writing it because it allowed me, I mean, I sat down in rooms with old hustlers who had done jail time, who, some that didn't do jail time, but really had played a significant role in the 60s in Harlem. And I sat down with them, and I was able to really make sure, because I was writing that book for the Fed's audience, and I had to make sure that I was writing something that was true to what was occurring at the time that book was written. So it was a real good, it was real eye-opening to write a book that really, you know, captured that period of time, because the series starts in the 60s and it takes you through each generation of Harlem. So you follow a family through Harlem's growth as well. And the first book is based in the 60s, before even, right at the time that drugs actually come into Harlem.
Okay. All right, so the first one is under Mind Candy, and the second one's under the Feds, right?
Yeah, Once Upon a Time in Harlem is, that is actually published by Feds Magazine. Trifling Times of Nathan Jones is published by my company, Mind Candy. And I have the second part of the Trifling Times called The Game of Trife coming out in December through Mind Candy as well.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about Mind Candy. Should we expect to see some other authors under your publishing house?
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt. Mind Candy, if you go to mindcandymedia.com, you can find out about the company. Really, with that company, what I had as my initial like motto for the company was a publisher of intelligent urban fiction. I think that that within my works that I'll definitely transcend just writing urban fiction works. But what I try to do with Mind Candy is not just focus on books, screenplays as well, but also to play a significant role in literacy, because my focus is not only on making quality, where when I say Mind Candy, it's something that I'm feeding your mind. I'm not just giving you just a work that has no basis for elevating you and taking you to that next level, whether it's creatively or just intelligently, but I also know that I have to play a significant role in helping to improve our literacy rates in our communities, our dropout rates, because that's something significant. And it wouldn't even be, as a man that cares about my community, it wouldn't even be manly if I didn't realize how much of a role I should be playing in that. So the Mind Candy also had a literacy program. I'm going to be doing a mentorship program. My literacy program was based on essay writing, and it was focused on Black and Hispanic teens. That will be my focus going forward, just to try to basically get into our communities and get our children reading, because when you look at even the rates in jail of prisoners that are incarcerated, the majority of them don't even have a better than fourth grade reading level, you know. And so it's important. It just shows you how important literacy is. So with Mind Candy, it's not just publishing. I mean, I'm looking for authors that could step up the game and add something to the game. But I'm also looking for people that want to be activists or just play a role in uplifting our communities as well.
That sounds excellent. We have at Culture Fresh, we have a program called Project Read, and also I know at Urban Literary Review, we're starting up with a project called Literacy Can Help. So definitely we need to partner up on these things and make sure that one of the things I found interesting, which I didn't know, I did I think it's the National Institute, the NIH, has a website, .gov, and it talks about literacy. And I didn't know that only 8% of African Americans, this was in 2002, are considered literate in the entire United States. And I was stuck, so I said, what's literate, you know? And it broke down how it's not just reading, it's not just applying it, but it's reading and applying and then taking it to another level. So I thought it was reading an application, but it's also reading and applying it to actually serve to do another purpose. And they bring out specific, like when you download the PDF, they bring out specific tasks they gave people, whether it was, and they went through the prison system. And it was funny, I thought the prison system would be less than the actual outside population. And the prison system has a little bit more literate African-Americans in it than the outside world. So I don't know what that means as far as, like, people getting locked up and being smart, but being literate is an interesting concept versus just knowing how to read.
And it's interesting that you say that, because one time I held the college professor to task because he had released something that was really, it was distributed in different periodicals, and it said it was basically a study on the most literate states and the most literate cities, and it put Atlanta up there. I think Atlanta was number two. And at the time, with dealing with certain groups in Atlanta, I knew that you had a big, literacy was a real big problem at the time, you know? And I mean, and you're talking about an area where you have a dropout rate of like 40% when it comes to Black and Hispanics in that high school. So when I challenged him about that, he said, well, what they look at, when they look at these areas and determine if the area is literate, he said he based his survey was based off of how many magazines and newspaper subscriptions were in a certain area geographically. So, you know, because of the fact that you have you have a certain amount of subscription rate in an area. That's how you determine whether or not that area is literate enough, you know. But it's really, when it comes down to it, we know that we have, that there's, you know, an issue in our communities. And I also think that it's a lot of people come down hard on writers of urban fiction. And when I'm on the subways or when I'm anywhere and I see a child reading, I'm happy to see him reading, because if it's going to be that urban book or whatever it is that's going to be their gateway, let them start there, and maybe that will lead them to other things. But if they're not reading, they're just not reading. And there's a lot of distractions to keep them away from reading. So I feel good seeing them read anything. I feel good also just with the fact, the state of literature for African Americans right now. I mean, the fact that I'm on this show and we have a show focused on this,
right,
you know, that says it all.
Exactly. What do you think, though, as far as, I know we got to wrap it up, but I just want to get one question in, T. What do you think is going to be the solution, though, going forward? Because I won't say classically trained, but you have a certain training from journalism to writing. But do you have these people that we may reach out to in the prison system, you may reach out to, and they're not being exposed to James Baldwin. You know, they're being exposed to the street literature, and so they think that's the only story we have. And so while we do have young people reading, what do you think is to take it to the next step, which is to now expand into science fiction? There was just a call out for black writers to submit manuscripts if it was urban horror, but they didn't want werewolves or vampires. But if you had an urban horror story or urban love horror story, there was two or three labels looking for that. So, you know, what do you think it's going to take for us to expand the writing styles, the writing genres, and get more writers writing all different types of styles?
I think what it's going to take is for the authors to expand themselves. And let me put it to you this way. There's plenty of authors that people go to. They go to vendors. They go to stores specifically looking for those authors or specifically looking for books from a certain company. So there's authors that have a readership, there's companies that have built a readership. Now, the problem is that a lot of these companies or a lot of these authors don't take the next step to develop their craft. Because within developing your craft, you need to understand how to tell stories. Like, you may start off telling your story about, I sold drugs and I went to jail for 20 years and I came out, and you give your story about everything that occurred in your life, and that's good. Then you write another book and it's another variation of that same thing, or something that happened to your boy and it's the same thing. But if you were developing your craft, you're able to take it from that to your life experience now and expand upon it. But I don't think enough people really want to develop their craft also. So they're stuck in a bubble. And the readers love them, so they're looking at their next book, and the reader is stuck in that same bubble. And they never step outside of that. I mean, the only thing that I pray for is that as I develop my readership continues to grow and move with me, because there's so many stories I want to tell. Because I know that there's a responsibility. I already have science fiction books written. I have horror books written, you know. But the thing about it is that you have to get your readers there. So if you're dealing with somebody who has never been exposed to anything, and you give them something, and they like, it's like you give them ice cream, and they like that flavor, you have to, you know, you may give them that same flavor a couple of times because they're afraid to try something new, but then gradually you expose them to other things. You know, next thing they have a banana split. You know, they have something else that they're eating, that they're trying. And I think it's up to the authors to continue to challenge their readers. And they need to challenge themselves. And you challenge yourselves by stepping outside of the box and offering them something new, something different, you know. And that's the only way that we could get readers to say, okay, I want to try a book by Ralph Ellison. I reference other books or other authors or John Henry Clark or somebody else in my books to subliminally get that person there to say, why did he reference this? Let me take a look at that. But that's what it takes. If you want them to see Richard Wright, or you want them to look at James Baldwin, you have to as well have looked into these things. You have to be familiar with it. And once you're familiar with those things, you can kind of put your readers on. You know, it's like hip-hop, and I don't want to talk too much, but if you think about Public Enemy, when Public Enemy say, the follower of Farrakhan, there's thousands and thousands of people who never even heard of Farrakhan.
Right.
But that one line made them say, let me figure out who Farrakhan is. You know what I'm saying? Because I like Public Enemy, and that's what Public Enemy said. So all I'm saying is if you're an author and you think that you're sitting there and you're doing the same thing each time you're writing a book, it's just a different variation of the same thing, you got to develop your skills. But within doing that, you also need to take little steps to make sure your readers go with you, because your readers will follow you. They love you. They love your ability to tell stories. So they want to hear any story you have to tell as long as it's told in a compelling way. And you build strong characters, and you bring them there. People don't read John Grisham books because they think that John Grisham is black or he's white, or James Patterson because of his skin color, or because he tells a story about the hood. They read his books because he tells compelling stories. They tell compelling stories. And that's the thing. You know, that's what we have to do.
We have a call on the line. I'm not sure if it's for the promotion that we're running for the next segment or if it's a call for you, but I'm going to pick it up anyway. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, how are you? My name is Linda Brickhouse, and I was just listening. I guess I'm a little for both. I was listening to the dialogue that you just got finished having, and I was listening to the brother explaining how reaching other readers, how to get them to, I guess, broaden their horizons when it comes to other authors and other genres of reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, wow, it's great. It's he really hit it on the head. He made all the points that I guess I would have made had I had gotten the opportunity to speak first. So congratulations, and thank you for plucking my thoughts from osmosis. Thank you for having the courage even to say that it is more than just what's written or what we write for ourselves and about ourselves, but it's what is written completely. Not just for African Americans, but for all folk, that we have the opportunity to broaden where we're going and what we're looking for.
Thank you. I mean, thank you for your comment, because really, ultimately, if we want to take our books and we want to make sure that our authors continue to get the respect of all authors out there, you know, I mentioned James Patterson and I mentioned John Grisham, and I know that we in our communities and our authors, we have authors that are just as great, if not better than them, but they're not respected on that level because they put us in a box. We have to continue to, you know, expand and not only expose our readers to other things, but make sure everybody knows that we're not like a one-trick pony. We could tell several different stories because there's so much, you know, there's so much to us as a people, that there's so many stories about us as a people that aren't out there yet, you know. But in the same respect, it's a fascinating and incredible time for African American literature, and that's why, you know, I just celebrate everybody's success, because there's a lot of people doing a lot of good things, you know, at this point in time.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm very familiar with Martin from Culture First, and one of the things that I've always said is that recently we've gotten this big explosion of authors who look like us, who are writing stories about us, who are telling stories. But one of the things that is glorified for us is that although they look like us and they're telling the negative sides of our stories, and they're also telling some positive sides, it's the negative aspect that is really getting the I guess, the hoopla, the big celebration. You know, like it's something new.
Yeah.
You know, we're exposing the rest of the world to what we know, what we've lived, or what we perceive to be true about us. However, we have to broaden what they don't know about us.
You're right. And we have to also make sure that when somebody takes that step or is courageous enough to do those things, that we support them, whether that's in books or whether it's in film. Like Spike Lee, I remember when he made a film, Get on the Bus, and a lot of people didn't go out opening weekend to see it. You know, there's a lot of films that when, you know, A Boys in the Hood or A Menace to Society, will make a lot of money in his first weekend. It will be perceived as successful, and that's why you have film companies try to repeat that and make other films like that. Publishers do the same thing. They look at, okay, True to the Game was successful, and they want another True to the Game, you know. And the way that we also kind of, you know, I told a friend one time that Ferris Bueller's Day Off, a story about nothing except kids cutting out of school, you know, white kids cutting out of school. We have those stories too. How come I don't see those films? You know,
right.
And that's the
why is the only one Walter Dean, the young adult writers guy, Walter Dean. I can't think of his name. He writes. I can't think of his name, but it's like he's the only one that's writing for kids, teenagers from 13 to 16. And I was like, dang, can somebody else? Like, can we get, like, 4 of them or 5 of them?
But I kind of think that's because we're so critical of, you know, it's almost like stepping out on a limb. I can take this step, and I might even leap. But when I leap, who's going to be there to hold me up? Working at Barnes & Noble's years ago, that was one of the myths that African-American people don't read. So we won't put their books on our shelves. So the authors that we were reading then were basically Anglo folk. And now we're saying, okay, they're reading, but it's what they're reading, and we still don't, you know, we're kind of scared of certain things. So if my sister or my brother decides to take that leap, who will, you know what I mean? Who is going to catch her or him? Who is actually picking up that book? Because most teens, I've got 2 boys, 16 and 17, they're not reading those teenage books. They're at that adult level where they're saying, we don't want to read about that.
That's because their mama trained them to read when they was 4. So that's really at the average teen.
Okay. Linda, hold on for 1 second for us, okay?
Okay.
Sure.
All righty. Alrighty, Moses, give me all of your contact information and how my book clubs and my my stores and my vendors can get in contact with you.
Yeah, without a doubt. The website is mindcandymedia.com. You could also check triflingtimes.org. It has some information on some of the, when I mentioned some of the cases of victimization in New York. I can be reached directly via email, whether that's book clubs or speaking engagements as well, at moses@mindcandymedia.com. And for those in the Baltimore area, on Saturday, this coming up Saturday, I'll be at Caribou doing 2 signs at the Iverson Mall and also at, I think it's called the Forest or something like that.
Forestville Mall.
Yeah, there you go.
Come on the show and not say that you're with DC Bookman, too.
Oh, please. DC Bookman is family. DC Bookman has been
family.
Hey,
we're open Saturday if you're still in the area.
Oh, all right. With
okay.
DC Bookman, of course.
Congratulations, so.
Yeah,
if
DC Bookman
is family. Definitely come through.
All right.
Okay. Excellent. All right, and what's your
Thank
next
you.
Project really quickly?
My next project will be The Game of Trife, and that will be, it's scheduled right now to be released on December 24th. The significance of that is those that read The Trifling Times of Nathan Jones know that the main characters in that book lost their parents on that same date, and that will be the release of the second book. So I'm looking forward to releasing that, and I'm hoping to follow up with a couple of books every few months following that.
Okay.
Dang, Moses, you keep trying to make us think. Stop making us
think.
Well, thank you again for calling in this evening, and we definitely will have you back on the show to discuss your new project once it's released.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the caller calling in as well.
Okay. Have a great evening.
You too.
Bye.